to another episode of Mention and Dispatches. We are in season 5 of the official podcast, The Armchair Dragoons. And here with us this evening, we say evening because of when we record it. We don't care when you're listening to it. But here with us on this episode, we've got a pretty full house tonight, and they are all fresh faces to Mentioned in Dispatches. From left to right on your podcast dial, we have Mr. Sebastian Bay, who is an instructor in the wargaming program over at Georgetown University. Howdy, Mr. Sebastian.
How you doing, Brent?
Doing great, doing great. And then we've got a pair of students from that program, Nicholas Rice. Nicholas, how are you tonight?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
And am I correct? You are a current student in the program, right?
I actually just got my diploma yesterday.
Oh, wow. Congrats. Very awesome. And then, Caitlin, I'm going to mess up your last name. I'm sorry.
It's all good. I'm Caitlin Leong.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you are already out of Sebastian's program though, right?
So I took Sebastian's class last fall, but I will be at Georgetown until I graduate in May of 2021.
Yeah. So still a student, just done with Sebastian.
Yeah. No escape hatch for me. I'm actually the president of the Wargaming Society, and with Sebastian as our faculty advisor, we actually work more closely than we did when I was in his class.
So stuck with him a little bit. All right. So hold that thought. We're going to get back to you about the Wargaming Society. We do want to start with Sebastian, though. This is in large part sort of built around this wargaming class that you have at Georgetown. And just for the audience, this is a single class. This isn't like a series of classes or a degree program or anything, correct?
No, the class, which is called Basics of Wargaming, is seated within the Center for Security Studies, or the Security Studies Program, which is seated within the wider School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. So at present, this is the second time I'm running it this fall. Caitlin and Nikolai were part of the first cohort last year in 2019 when they were part of that class. But yes, at the present, it is only an intro class at the moment, but we hope that one day we can expand it with other instructors, but also other classes that build out the wider wargaming skill set.
Gotcha. In the past, we've had Dr. Sterrett on here in his official capacity out at CGSC, where they actually have a master's program in the wargaming. It's a concentration in the Masters of Military Art and Science, but a wargaming concentration. And so there's a whole sequence of classes with those guys. I didn't think you guys were up to a sequence yet, but kind of wanted to confirm for the audience sort of where that was. Just to fill in some of the background here, how the heck did this start? Like, who knocks on the door at Georgetown and says, "Hi, I want to teach a wargaming class"? How did you get to this point?
So actually, it's quite funny. I actually never intended to start a class. I actually went to the administration because I was an alumni of the program a couple of years ago, and I wanted to start a wargaming club on campus. After some back and forth emails, the administration was like, "We would love to, but we can't for various legal and liability issues because you're not a student or a faculty, right?" So they offered to me to run a couple seminars or guest lectures for the students. And being like the low new person on campus on the guest roster, I got like Sundays. But shockingly, over like, you know, 50 people showed up to the first one, and another good showing came up to the next one. So after ginning up some student interest, the administration the following year asked me, after doing it in the fall and the spring, if I wanted to work on a syllabus and creating a 4-credit course in the fall. And this was in 2019. So in the summer of 2019, I pretty much worked on the syllabus with the help of many probably familiar names of like the professional wargaming crowd, like, you know, Ed McGrady, Mike Arnberger, you know, James Sterrett, you know, among others, who gave me lots of feedback on what they learned in their courses and what they wish they did include or did not include in their own courses. So after a summer of struggle with the syllabus, there was another, you know, semester of trial and experimentation that Nikolai and Caitlin will tell you, because they were my guinea pigs. You know, this was my first time teaching. This was my first time teaching wargaming. So it was all new for everybody. And they were great in the sense of providing feedback, but also working with me as I learned the ropes as I went along. And, you know, again, after that, their class, I adapted the syllabus with their feedback and what I learned. The first one being don't assign so much reading. And you know what I mean? So, you know what I mean? This syllabus, the syllabus they, my students right now have in the fall, is totally different. Not totally different, but it's drastically different in the sense that we shift around a lot of the readings. We added a different book and replaced one of the larger books that we found was a little too difficult for intro class. But yes, it evolved a lot, and I expect it to evolve into the future.
Excellent. The you mentioned that whole first time teaching class. It sucks to be given a blank piece of paper and say, here, design a syllabus. It's a lot easier when somebody else hands you a syllabus and say, here, please modify this. Having been in both of those seats in the past, it's a lot easier to edit than it is to create. So I definitely feel for you there. With regards to putting the class together, obviously there's only so much you can do with an intro program. The sense that I get is that you were far more focused on sort of the professional applications, those practitioners, the defense and security world as much as anything else. And so with that as a focus, how did that, because I know you're also a hobby wargamer, like just correspondence that we've had and conversations we've had over, you know, over time. How do you scope that so that you're able to talk practitioner level stuff while still covering sort of the groundings and the basics of what wargaming is?
So the first thing I learned in the process of writing a syllabus was you have to scope your class. My first draft of my syllabus was too long, too heavy, and you know, it would crush students. Not that the last iteration of that first version was any better. But one of the things I went out to be deciding was that the class should focus on core things. And I sort of apply the design principle tenets that I teach my students when they're approaching games, is that what are the core organizing principles you want for your class slash game and Yurine. So I told myself that we would focus on educational gaming because I wanted to create a virtual cycle where the students could go back into their program or go out into the world and use it as a positive educational tool. The second part was I wanted to focus on their understanding of how war game design principles work and how they actually perform those tools and those principles in actually doing war game design. Because I have a firm believer that wargaming as a designer, you have to learn by doing. So, and the last part was addressing the larger intellectual principles and thinkers of our wargaming community as a profession discipline. So part of the literature that they review in their class is about reading some of the wider thoughts and concepts about wargaming, both as a profession, as a discipline, and as designers. And that includes Thieves That Own Smarns, you know what I mean, Three Witches of Adjudication, CNA's seminal work on the pathologies of wargaming, and other authors in the field like Peter Perla, Phil Sabin, when it comes to educational gaming. And it was to give them a wider understanding of the principles and actors that are out there in the wargaming field.
All righty. So Caitlin, Nick, you guys are students. Somebody throws this idea out there and says, hey, we got a class on wargaming. What do you think? Nick, what was the first thing that came across your mind? Like when that hit, what were you thinking?
I was thinking this is the coolest and most creative class that I see on the roster of classes that we had available to us. And I think that after taking a bunch of research and reading, you know, intensive classes where the most creative thing you get to do is write a paper on a topic you choose, I really wanted to learn about how to build and how to design a war game. I have a minor in creative writing, even though I have a bachelor's in international studies. So I was always really interested in the creative side of modeling problems and writing about them. I think that Sebastian probably had a lot of guts going into this, and I'm really glad that he went through with it, because I'm just, you know, so happy to have gotten into this class and gotten through the class. You know, it totally, totally paid off.
What was your exposure to wargaming before Sebastian's class?
Civilization 4, 5, and 6. I had not really played, you know, any tabletop or anything else besides, you know, commercial games. It was definitely a lot of reading in the first few weeks, but even coming from the commercial game side, there are just some, you know, basic aspects of design and basic aspects of gameplay that Sebastian was able to point out to us that, you know, even I immediately understood exactly what we were aiming for in the class.
Caitlin, when you saw Intro to Wargame Design on the course catalog, what were you thinking?
So I was really excited about it. I actually rearranged my schedule that first semester that I was in the program so that I could take Basics of Wargaming. Because I don't know if Sebastian remembers this, but he was at our Admitted Students Day and he was handing out cards trying to drum up interest in this class. And I remember thinking to myself, you know, I had gotten into wargaming on the professional side in undergrad. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, you know, I'm probably going to have to give this up. I'm going to have to leave it behind to do, you know, security stuff, defense analysis. There's no way I can make a career out of this. And then meeting Sebastian at Admitted Students Day, I was like, oh, you know, maybe there's something to this. And then seeing the course as an option and seeing that there were still spots open when I registered as a lowly first year, I was like, this is what I want to do. This is how I want to spend, you know, my first semester in the program, because I was really looking to build the, I guess, street cred, for lack of a better way to put it, to say, you know, like, hey, I've had these varied wargaming experiences over the last 4.5 years. And now I want something to really back it up if I want to go into this professionally. And Sebastian's class, you know, paid off in spades in that sense. So, you know, the first thing that I thought was like, oh, wow, you know, interesting that Georgetown is offering this, because as best I could tell at the time, you know, it wasn't really something that was an option outside of the professional military education institution. So I was really excited to see the course offering.
So it sounds like you'd had at least some exposure to wargaming before you got to the point of registering for the class.
Yeah, I had. I was, I guess, lucky in the sense that when I first moved to DC for college, I kind of didn't know what I wanted to do. And I had stumbled into an undergraduate student org called Strategic Crisis Simulations at George Washington University, which essentially runs these large scale political military seminar style war games for students and young professionals. And I got into the professional, you know, DC sense of wargaming that way. But I was the super cool kid in high school who would get invited to a party and then like go raid their game cabinet and convince like two other nerds to play Risk. So I had a general idea of what I was getting myself into, but I was looking for something to sort of formalize those ad hoc experiences that I had had.
I think for a lot of us that have experience in the professional wargaming ranks, I've been in that community. I'm not currently in it, but I've been there before. I think we would all look around at each other and go, well, how did you stumble into this business? Because as noted, and Caitlin, you actually wrote an article about this at one point, like there's no sort of defined way in which you get into this business. I mean, there's everybody completely backs into it. I don't know. You may be the first person I've ever met who, you know, going into college is like, I want to do that when I come out the other end. Like there's Sebastian, have you ever met somebody in the professional wargaming ranks that grew up going, that's what I want to do?
Actually, I think the large majority of us stumbled into it, myself included. Caitlin was the only student in my class that had any sort of like real wargaming experience, and especially in the DoD realm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like over in the IT world, the business analysts that work, you know, requirements and documentation and stuff, you'll never find anybody who's a business analyst in the IT world that grew up wanting to be a business analyst. Everybody stumbles into it through some other means, and nobody really plans for it. And I mean, we've seen that again talking with the guys who've been around forever, right? The Peter Perlers and Mike Markowitzes of the world. You know, they stumbled into it and have sort of stayed there for 30 years or more in some cases. And we've seen in the past, there's no real defined glide path of how you get into this world. So Sebastian, as you're building this class, was this a bit of a lark just so that we've got more people exposed to what wargaming is, or is there some evil master plan you have locked in a vault somewhere that's sort of how to use this as a wedge to start growing new wargamers to fill the professional ranks when we start losing the Markowitzes and Perlas to, you know, wanting to go hang out in Tahiti with the fruity drink on the beach?
A little bit of both. So a part of it was to just expose people to a very cool analytical tool and discipline that I learned out in the job market, right? I learned my wargaming skills on the job down at Quantico. But a wider part of it, the secret, you know, maniacal plan is to produce wargamers for the long term, people who are invested in the field, who want to advance. And I would say, on average, I expect of a 14 person class, maybe two, maybe one of them will, you know, be interested beyond the class, right? My first cohort was probably their rarity, in the sense that Caitlin, Nikolai, and Sawyer, who was another member that you know, were all very interested in wargaming by the end of the class, and showed signs of, you know, of going, pursuing it beyond the class. And hopefully I get one or two in my current class in the fall to keep going with it one way or another. But a part of it is to grow that next generation of wargamers, is because, you know, there are no ladders, there's no roadmap to how to become a wargamer. But the thing is that we should not rely on happy accidents to produce the next generation of wargamers. My fear is that when the Markowitzes, the Perlas, the Sabins, the James Sterrets of the world, where the Stacy Pettedrons, when they all retire, what happens, right? What happens when Yuna Wong is no longer a keynote speaker at Connections all the time, right? The question happens, who replaces these people and their skills and their experiences and their knowledge? And my fear is that we will have to relearn all their hard-earned lessons. And my hope is that my generation learns from our older generations, but more so that we make sure there's someone who follows up behind us.
So it's not just because you need extra opponents on the weekend at the game club.
Oh, that too. I always enjoy that. Caitlin and Nikolai can always tell you about our office hours and their first exposure to Game of Thrones Risk at office hours.
I'm sure that there's been, as soon as you said the word Risk right there, there were a whole lot of pearls being clutched amongst our audience that is thinking, wait, you're using Risk to teach wargaming? But I guess when you boil it all down, Risk is sort of the most pure form of war game you've got out there, right? I mean, it's the only way to win is to kill everybody.
So that's a good example. So a lot of people, especially like hardcore hobby gamers, look at Risk and they're like, oh, this is a silly game, right? But I would say that if you're teaching war game design, right, you're not just about realism and the most complex games, you're also teaching them why games end up the way they did, right? So when we talk about Risk, or even Game of Thrones Risk, which is a game I love to use to teach, right? It's because it's one of the first games I expose to my students, because it is simple, it is accessible. Most people find it something they know already in terms of the Risk mechanic and the adjudication system. So it's not daunting for them. And again, you got to remember, like, I don't know the level of wargaming or gaming experience my students have. So some of them may come off the street never even playing Risk, right? So Game of Thrones Risk is usually something very easy, accessible, culturally, you know what I mean, cool for their generation. And I really enjoy the game. And we talk about why the game is designed the way it is. What are some of the benefits? One of the benefits of the Risk model is that the adjudication is super simple. You're designed for children. And the combat logic behind it is that mass is what matters, right? Especially in the traditional Risk, where you're running around the board, waiting to build a horde of like 50 army troops and coming out of Australia or South America, like Genghis Khan, right? We all been there. And then eventually you just wither your enemies down until they're so tired of dice rolling that they give up. Game of Thrones Risk is different. It changes the fundamental Risk system a little bit to tweak it in the favor of the defense. So you don't have these huge hordes running around. And it's a great way to understand how small mechanics can change the dynamic of a game. And we use it as a study in design, not only just play. And then we use other games throughout the class that introduce different design elements. So when I'm selecting games for them to play, not only am I choosing something that is interesting to them to play and something that'll grab their attention and that'll be fun, but also trying to introduce them to specific design principles, simple ways of making the theory that we talk about class grounded in something they have experience, right?
Without giving away too many of the trade secrets of the class, besides Game of Thrones Risk, what were a couple of the other games you put in front of them? So, in the context of class, not like during office hours or extracurricular stuff, but on the syllabus.
Yeah, so on the syllabus, I've done this more on this last class in terms of assigning rule books to look at. For example, this year where we're looking at PMP games and print to play games, I've assigned Battle for Moscow as their key thing to build off, because I think it's a beautiful design game. It's really good. And if you can model your game after something that is as elegantly designed as Battle for Moscow, the students will do a great job in the class, right? There are other games that I also assign, but one system that we talk about a lot in our class is Frederick, due to the way it uses event cards, but also the point-to-point system overlaid with a zone system for combat. So, like, I try to use game systems that are interesting. Like, this year we talked about Combat Commander and their use of cards, because as Volko talked about this earlier this week, the cards are, like, jam-packed with information, right? And I think there are interesting ways to use cards, and that's one of them. And so we try to use games that are interesting in terms of design, but also content, also a wide range of conflicts, because, you know, I mean, how you model and design a game for ancient warfare is fundamentally different of how you do it for modern warfare, where you have combined arms and multi-domain operations.
Caitlin, of all the games that hit the table for the class, which one did you enjoy the most? And why did that one stick out to you?
So I have to say it's probably a tie just in the context of our group project. So I played Game of Thrones Risk against Sebastian at his very first office hours, and I got my butt kicked. And I immediately went and bought the game because I was like, I have to figure out where I failed, like where my strategy is not working. And it has since become the most popular game in my friend group and my household. And there's a lot of elements of that we borrowed for our design project, but our group particularly enjoyed, we borrowed Sebastian's copy of Commands and Colors Ancients. And I think it was all a ploy to get us to stick the stickers for him on the little wood blocks, because we spent an entire Saturday doing that.
And it worked.
It did. It worked. Although, Sebastian, there might be a couple stickers that are a little wonky because we got lazy towards the end. So we played that probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 different times just as a playtest, and then eventually for fun as we were designing our game. And we had a lot of fun with it because every time we tried a different battle, you know, we had to set up the terrain and we had all these different card hands, and then we were like learning new rules every time. And it was a really good way for us to see, you know, what sort of elements can you have in a game. But honestly, we just had fun figuring out the rules. And I'm glad to hear that some rule books are getting assigned out in this next iteration of the course, because I know Nikolai spent a lot of time poring over the rule books of the games that we looked at for our project. And I think there's a lot of value in understanding the rule set. But I would have to say for our group, it was a tie between Game of Thrones, Risk, and Commands and Colors Ancients.
Nikolai, same question. What game really stuck out to you within the class and why?
Well, for us, I think the one that had the most effect on our final game was definitely Command and Colors. Even though we came up with a strategy-based game and it is, you know, tactical to its core, what I do want to say is that when Sebastian has us play game, he has us think very deeply in each of our actions for everything that we do. Constantly questions us in a devil's advocate kind of way, asking if that's really what we want to do. And I think that the game that I was most fascinated by in the class by far was Frederick, mostly because of the card mechanic and how combat works in that game, where you have, you know, essentially the card game war that you play with your opponent, and being able to outdraw them in the cards that you already have in your hands. And it takes the whole dice mechanic of adjudicating combat out of wargaming. And that was something, you know, that we had talked about in class. And I was like, yeah, but how well is that going to work? How else are you going to be able to prove or adjudicate that your army is better, you know, and that you're a better strategist? And in that game, strategy is abstracted to keeping your cards close to your chest, quite literally, and making sure that you are well prepared when you go into battle, not just in terms of numbers, but in terms of options that you have in your hand. And, you know, as far as Game of Thrones Risk goes, I do want to say that Sebastian has a liberal reading of the rules, and there are additional rules that he makes for everyone who plays with him that everyone has to follow. But there is, I think, no beating Sebastian. I think that the first student who beats Sebastian in Game of Thrones Risk just should automatically get an A in the class.
Sebastian, was there one in particular that you had a lot of fun with teaching other than Game of Thrones Risk? Was there something else in there that really stuck out as, hey, this was a great time had by all, not just in the context of there was an important teaching point behind it?
So Game of Thrones actually is one of my favorites to use to teach, because we play, like Nikolai has mentioned, we use house rules, and I use house rules to balance the game because I think it is more interesting that way. And actually I introduced a little bit of more unknown uncertainty and actually a little bit of deterrence. For example, in the game, in the house rules that we play, there's a card in the game that essentially like wipes out an entire army regardless of size if you're being attacked. It's called Let Into Trap. There's only one originally in the game, but in the way I designed the house rules is that everyone gets it. Usually we put it on a post-it note or something. But the notion is that card serves as like a deterrent and allows the players that are four, fifth in the sequence to sort of like avoid being ganged up on. But also at the same time, you have this, you know what I mean, notion of when do I use this, right? And also, there's the notion of where is it in the deck? So there's a bit of that. Another actually new game that I've been using more and more because of the virtual environment is actually Accents and Allies. Again, I had to find an easy, accessible game that everyone could sort of learn. And so we could talk through. So we use Zoom to talk over audio. And then we play Accents and Allies 1942 online via Steam. So as the students are playing, sort of what Nikolai referenced to, I will ask them questions about design. I will ask them questions about their decision making. After the games sessions, we will talk about what did you like, what didn't you like. And I found the game can be really rich if you know how to use it. And a lot of people who are like hardcore gamers would be like, oh my God, there's so many other games that are better. Yes, there are, right? But again, you're as an educator, and this is something everyone has to understand, is like games are contextual and their use and their utility varies depending on context. For example, a Absolutely. Game that I need is limited by 2.5 hours I have with my students. That means I got to be able to teach them within like 15, 20 minutes and then run a couple, 3 or 4 turns within a 2-hour time, right? If your awesome game doesn't fit that market, right, then it's not really useful to, right? And James, Sarah, and I have these discussions all the time of like looking for really good educational commercial games. And sometimes the constraints of the class are difficult. And sometimes you can go a little over those constraints in the sense that Game of Thrones can be like a 3-hour, 4-hour game. But at the same time, I could teach it to them. And actually, they are the ones who are like, can we stay a little bit longer, right? And in this virtual environment, the limiting factor was actually finding games that they could learn on their own, which would require some kind of AI, in my preference. And I may change that for the future. But in this term, I wanted games that had AIs that allow them to solo play and have multiple iterations. And I also wanted a game that was, one, inexpensive for me to purchase for them. So I didn't want them to purchase the games themselves. And another one was that looking at the design mechanics. So one of the very interesting discussions we had about Axis and Allies as we were playing it was a weird way the map is drawn on Axis and Allies, right? It doesn't make geographic and spatial sense, but the map is drawn a specific way by the designers to encourage certain players to do certain action. That the U.S. is discouraged from, or not discouraged, but it is more difficult to go to and do a Normandy landing, and it takes you about 2 or 3 turns to get over there, right? Versus you can go straight to Operation Torch in one turn, right? Although it's like the same distance. It makes no sense. But it's a designer's choice to sort of make you follow that historical arc. The same weird map drawing happens in the Pacific, where the U.S. is encouraged to go down to the Marianas, right? Into like, you're in the South Pacific. Meanwhile, going straight to Japan is discouraged. So, and we talk about these things, and the idea is like, what do you like? What don't you like? One of the students brought up is that they don't like the fact that all units are the same, that a tank, whether it be a Japanese or German, that they're all the same. There should be some difference. I'm like, okay, all right, how would you incorporate that in your game? And these are the discussions I want. If they learn something about history and gameplay and strategy and improve their critical thinking, that's great. But for me, as a teacher of design, I want them to really think about the fundamental design of why a game works the way it does.
The context thing, I think, is vastly underrated, and it's something that I don't think enough people have an appropriate appreciation of in the odd seat that you're in of an instructor trying to get people just acclimated to what is this war game thing? Like, what are these things? How do you spend any time? You know, what do you do with them? What's the vernacular within the hobby and the industry? And you're right, there are constraints that you're going to have that other hobbyists may sort of, you know, cast aspersions on. The idea of risk as a teaching tool seems kind of silly until you really dig into why are you using that as the teaching tool. And I think that's an important point that unfortunately I think a lot of hobbyists are going to end up missing. And it's unfortunate because that kind of matters for the points you're trying to get across. And so I think you've done the right thing for the right reasons, even if there's always going to be some chucklehead in the back yelling out, play Case Blue, right? Case Blue has become the free bird of the wargaming world. I want a recommendation for something. There's always some idiot that shows up and yells Case Blue from the back of the room.
And there's lots of great games out there. Some are my favorites, but even some of my favorite games, you know, I mean, there are limited utility for them. And like, for example, I try to cater the games we play to the topics in which the students have chosen, right? So for example, this year, a lot of the teams have chosen, so one was the 1979 border war between China and Vietnam. And the other one has chosen a hybrid warfare in the Ukraine. So like for one group, we tried to do lots of like counterinsurgency, asymmetrical warfare. I actually recommended Root to them. And for the other group, we do more operational, more tactical level wargaming for them, and try to get them inspired for those things. So I also try to line it up to their interests and their projects, so it can more directly feed into what they want. Sort of what we did for Command and Colors for Nikolai and Caitlin.
Yeah. As a side note, for folks that haven't stopped by the forums lately, we have a newer member who has used Commands and Colors, the Commands and Colors system, to teach some basic historical battle histories to fourth graders in his community where he lives. And he built the Commands and Colors tables that they put out in the classroom. Instead of wooden blocks to move around, he's got Lego figures. So he's got an entire Commands and Colors Ancients battle set up where it's all Lego figures moving around the map. And it's this massive thing. I mean, it takes up a banquet table. But it's kind of cool that he's using Lego figures to help keep fourth graders focused on the table with the game out there. It's, you know, it's one of those ingenious adaptations that you've got there. A quick clarification here, Sebastian, in terms of the stuff you've used in the class. As I understand it, now this semester's a bit of an exception just because of the plague, right? We can't get everybody around the same table, but your focus was manual wargaming, right? We weren't playing with digital toys. We were putting stuff on the table, correct?
Yeah, so the class is still sort of focused on that. So with Caitlin and Nikolai's cohort, we focus on sort of a commercial style educational game. Was the notion of one of the organizing rules that for their final project was you need to be able to hand this to somebody and they should be able to, one, learn something about your topic, two, be able to play it on their own. And we still have that general principle, but now we do print and play, mainly because of the reduced amount of face-to-face time groups can have, and they have to do everything virtual, and the coordination becomes a little more difficult. But yeah, so the class, again, in terms of scoping, is focused on manual gaming. And there are other classes, and if I could make other classes, I would do one on digital gaming and distributed gaming, one specifically on analytical gaming in the professional realm.
Caitlin, talk to us a little bit about the project that you guys did, and the sort of final assignment was, like Sebastian said, here's a game in a box, open it up, learn to play. Talk to us a little bit about your project. What was the topic? What was kind of the inspiration for you guys? And how do you think it turned out? And we'll make to chime in after that.
Yeah, so I won't steal too much of Nikolai's thunder, since ultimately the topic that we picked was the result of his historical interest and an area of research that he had been doing sort of for fun. So we decided to cover the Byzantine reconquest of the Italian peninsula in the 5th century. And we kind of copped out, admittedly. We were originally thinking of doing future conflict in the Baltic states, and Sebastian delivered this great lecture about how difficult it is to justify future projections in war games. And we were like, well, we only have 14 weeks to do this. So the day we were supposed to submit our dream sheet of topics, we turned to each other and Nikolai was like, hey, I know a lot about this. I'm confident in the historical source material. Would you guys be willing to bump this up to number one? And that's what we went with. And we ended up designing this really cool operational strategic level campaign game where you play either as the Romans or the Goths, and you have all of these objectives and cities that you're supposed to take. And then we added in card deck objectives and then also event cards. So, you know, you think everything's going great and you're going to march into Rome. Uh-oh, everybody's sandal straps broke. You can't go anywhere. And we were able to have a ton of fun building out this world and the map and the card decks and the game components. And ultimately what we handed in was, as best we could put together in 14 weeks, a formalized box set war game with a rule set that we were pretty confident that, you know, folks could open the box and figure out. And we did have a play test as our final exam where we basically handed it to our classmates and we said, hey, you know, figure it out. Let us know what doesn't make sense. You know, we're here if you need to ask questions. We were able also to print a much more professional copy through Georgetown's security studies program sponsoring us to then print a copy for the school. And it was really cool to go through the process from start to finish. But I'll let Nikolai jump in and talk a little bit more about how we picked the topic and some of the more interesting design elements, because that was primarily his add to the project.
You flatter me. I think we picked the topic, as Caitlin said, because we only had 14 weeks. We understood this was the first time that the class was being taught. And Sebastian had said when he read off the topics that whoever picked the Roman reconquest of Italy, the Byzantine reconquest of Italy, so long as we didn't do his boy Belisarius injustice, we'd get an extra point to our grade. And we just, you know, we flew with that. And I think that what was amazing for our topic was the fact that it's a war that is fairly important to world history, but very few people study it. It involves a general, Belisarius, who is probably one of the best generals in history, but very few people really study him. It takes place over several years that are also fundamentally important to world history, but are eclipsed because they happen in the Dark Ages. And there's, perhaps timely, a pan-Mediterranean plague that rolls through in the middle of our time period that we were studying. So that already gave us a unique design element to include. So, you know, besides having the plague of Justinian being able to roll through and ruin everybody's campaign, you know, in the middle of fighting over the Italian peninsula, we were able to include the ideas of factional infighting, because even though our game is two-sided, the conflict is two-sided, it's actually a four-player game. You have two Gothic leaders, and you have two Roman leaders, two Byzantine leaders. And in the end, one side wins, but really only one player wins. So you have to manage your ally and manage their expectations and your abilities, all while fighting your opponents. And I think that other than just teaching, you know, about the conflict and about the time period and about what operational warfare was like in that time, we were able to take Sebastian's ideas about managing other players in wargaming and figure out how to set up a dynamic where you have a friend, but that friend can and will also backstab you in order to win the game in the end. You know, Caitlin can speak to how well that worked, how well a four-player game worked with only three people in a group. But I think that she can say a lot more about how well we were able to manage our players' expectations when we actually gave them the full box set, which I have to say, she did all of the design elements and they were incredible. We have a gorgeous map and we have a gorgeous box and we have amazing cards, and they're all thanks to her.
So the inevitable follow-up question is, when are we going to see this in print from an actual commercial war game company? Are you guys shopping it around? When are we going to get our hooks into it?
So we are shopping it around, and you know, we're hoping to hear back from some folks about whether or not they're interested so that we can continue to shop it around. Hopes would be that sometime in the next 12 to 18 months, with everything being backed up because of the plague, that it might see the light of day. But we actually have, Nikolai and I did a presentation on the Wargaming Society's YouTube channel. If folks are interested in, you know, seeing what sort of components we designed and sort of how the game works, we did basically an entire walkthrough that was recorded and then posted online.
Yeah, I wasn't asking you to like give away any specific companies, so I hope you weren't feeling pressured for that. We just sort of always curious when we start hearing about, hey, there's this cool new something out there. All right, when do we get to play with it? That's the inevitable next question, isn't it? Sebastian, looking at the program, the class as it's built now, you've mentioned a couple of ideas that you would want to tackle in terms of sequels or branches from this class, ways to expand it beyond just a single class. One thing you mentioned was the idea of separating out digital versus manual. Give us your dream state. Like if somebody said, here's an endowed chair and a $5 million budget, go build us a program. What would you like to see? Where would you, like, I got it. We all want to hire Perla and Saban and Markowitz and these guys to be the rest of the professors. But absent that, like within the curriculum, what is it you would like to eventually see this grow into? I mean, if you're allowed to spill the beans and not give, you know, piss off all the other faculty members that might ever listen to this.
So I would love to create like a certificate program within the wider security studies program, so you can walk away with like something very similar to what Moores does or other entities do, like King's. But one of the things I would love to do in terms of our program is expand in terms of what other types of gaming do they do. Like my course really just teaches you about how to make an educational game, sort of that manual type in the box game. But there are other types of gaming. Like for example, like we don't really touch on matrix gaming. Like I expose them to them, but they don't really like open up and design a matrix game for themselves, which is totally different because a matrix game is heavier on the facilitation portion, heavier on the scenario portion versus the mechanical elements, which is really sort of pre-designed and pre-cooked into a matrix game. So one of the ways I would love to expand the program is to have one that is specifically tailored to like professional analytical gaming, because analytical gaming has different demands and different constraints and different prerogatives and different tools. And so for that course, I would focus a little bit more on like OR and how do you create more rigorous combat models and how do you convert those into game mechanics? How do you handle and juggle sponsor demands? What are some ways to design a professional game that is 400 people big, right? Like it's totally different than doing a 5-player commercial game style educational game in a controlled classroom environment when you're creating something that is much larger, like the Title 10 games for the services. So that's one thing I would want to do. Another one is to maybe branch out into distributed digital gaming. And this may dangerously like come close to other more like commercial gaming programs like MIT or Duke's like Game Lab or other universities that have like more commercial game designers. But I think it's a skill set that's really useful for the future and for our field of professional gaming. And the more digitally literate and computer literate the next generation will be, right? They won't be talking about, oh, we should do more distributed gaming. They'll be like, how can we make it better? Right. And they'll have the skill set to do so. And that's one of my hopes to prepare if I had an endowment to do so. And there are other things like, for example, if I had the money, I would hire other people who are really good at certain domains to do board gaming. Like, for example, Moores did a great tactical wargaming course that was that I had the honor of participating in as an instructor. And it was like an all-star team. Like if I was building a bench of like all-star wargamers, it was Peter Perda, Ed McGrady, Paul Weber, Phil Sabin, and they all got to talk about different domains. Like how do you do air combat, right? How do you do naval warfare, right? In games, right? For me, a lot of my experience, both as a hobby gamer and also as a professional wargamer is in land warfare, in Marine Corps warfare, sort of littoral, semi-naval, right? So if you ask me how to do like air combat, well, I don't play a lot of air games, nor have I done a lot of professional Air Force games, right? So that's something really out of my depth that I'm not super comfortable with. But I would love to have students like be able to pick the knowledge of other people who are more experienced in those things, right? Like Paul Weber can tell you all sorts of things of how submarines work and how you accurately and sort of plausibly model their behavior in naval warfare or age of sail or any of these things, right? And it's fascinating. I think it's really interesting for you to learn about different domains and how different domains have different demands and constraints and how you should think about them in terms of mechanic.
You've worked in the professional wargaming world. You're also a hobby gamer. If there's a lesson from the hobby gaming world that you want the Caitlins and Nikolais of the world to take with them into a potential professional career out there somewhere, do we have one or two simple bullet points that you would want those folks to take with them from the hobby side into the professional realm?
So the two that come off the top of my head is the first one is elegance is the goal. I don't say simplicity for a very specific reason, because you can have a simplistic game and not be good, right? I think elegant is the right word to describe games that are both smooth and simple to learn, but also dynamic and interactive. And the more you play it, the more it reveals, right? The higher the gameplay becomes, right? And those are the games when I play, both as a professional wargamer and as a commercial hobby gamer, that I'm like, I wish I designed this game, right? And I think that's a very important thing to learn, because there is a point of marginal returns, and not because. And I say that's important because for analytical gaming and in commercial gaming, there's an urge to always put in more. And I always tell my students this as well, is that there'll be a point where you will have to walk away and be like, enough, like we can't jam anything more. Right? There's not enough time. There's not enough conceptual space in this game. You're breaking our organizing principles, et cetera, whatever. And it's very important to be able to create, you know what I mean, that understanding of being able to walk away and be like, okay, this is the game system we have. But it's also good to have that goal that, you know what I mean, that far off goal of creating a simple, elegant, dynamic game. And I think that's true both in the professional and commercial world. And the second one is to be intellectual omnivores, is to, if you look at commercial designers and commercial companies and publishers, like they will borrow from everything and everything. They're like intellectual, like, you know what I mean, scavengers. They will steal, borrow, you know what I mean, emulate, you know what I mean, tweak. And that, I think there's
it's called research. They're doing research.
Yeah. And I tell my students this all the time, right? And I warn them, like, this is the first time in class that a professor will tell you plagiarism is okay, right? Go steal stuff from games that you like, right? And leave things you don't. And I think that's a very important lesson, both as a professional wargamer and as a commercial designer, is to look at what has worked, look at the history of gaming, look at what mechanics work. Like one of my favorite mechanics that I love is from Panzer Guderian, which is about the unknown combat values, right? I really love that because I think it really emulates the operational uncertainty of like, I don't know if this brigade's actually going to fight as a brigade, right? And I'm just waiting for the day that I get to use it in a professional war game. And I think that's really great. And I think they should really take that sort of intellectual curiosity and their ability to learn from different mediums into their professional lives. Like one of my favorite things that I saw from last year's group was the group that did the Three Kingdoms China game. They actually found a graphic novel in the Georgetown Library about the Three Kingdoms. And they were like, oh yeah, this was really sort of boiled down like sort of this dense Chinese history into these sort of like stories, right? And I'm like, that's really great. Like that will teach you how to tell a story with your characters in your game, right? And I think that's a great way to think about it. Like borrow from graphic novels, borrow from storytelling, fiction writing, borrow from how military historians see history and the dynamics and factors and actors, right? Borrow from mathematicians who think about complex systems, right? Borrow from everybody and you'll be a better designer for it.
The joke has always been to steal from one is plagiarism, to steal from many is research. You mentioned at a certain point you can't jam anything more in, and I'm reminded of Mike Markowitz has brought this up. It's almost one of the points he's known for, similar to Stephen Downs Martin with his Three Witches article. Mike Markowitz always talks about the cycle of proliferation of complexity and ruthless simplification, right? And you're constantly doing one or the other. You'll cut a bunch of stuff out and then you'll start adding things back in. And then you'll have to go back and cut a bunch of stuff out again and then start adding some things back in. And it, you're right, at a certain point, you've just got to stop. And at a certain point, you've got to get off the merry-go-round. Caitlin, talk to us a little bit about Goose. You're the president or senior person over there. I think president is the actual title, right?
Yeah, so president is the actual title, although we're pretty informal as far as the executive committee structure is concerned. Mostly what we're looking to do with the Georgetown University Wargaming Society, or Goose as it's affectionately known, is just create a space at Georgetown where anybody who's interested in wargaming, regardless of how they've come into it, you know, whether it's just like, hey, you're hosting game nights, we'd like to hang out, or, oh, you know, I've been a hobby gamer for years and it's super cool that you guys have this, or, oh, I've identified that I want to be a professional wargamer, I want to add this to my analytical toolkit, can you connect me to folks in the community who do professional wargaming? We're just trying to be a space for all of that. And so we just got started in January of 2020, which seems like a decade ago at this point. And right now, since we're virtual, we are working on continuing our webinar series. So we do about a once weekly webinar with somebody from the wargaming community, you know, commercial game designers, professional wargamers, academics who speak on a variety of topics. We record those, we post them to our YouTube channel. So if anyone's interested in checking out what we've done, just type Georgetown University Wargaming Society into YouTube and you will find our channel and hours upon hours of webinars to entertain yourself. And then in addition to that, we are working on standing up some virtual game sessions using Vassal and Tabletop Simulator, potentially also Xbox and various game platforms on Steam, just to get folks together. We were intending to run a lot of game nights because we have this awesome game library. Lots of commercial game companies and hobby gamers have donated to us copies of their games. And so I think, Sebastian, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're somewhere around like 130 plus physical game copies. So whenever we get back to in-person, there's quite a bit to dig through. And basically what we have done over the last 7 to 8 months is just try to grow the community. You know, we've got folks from all over the world who tune in for these webinars. We've got people pinging us by email saying like, hey, I'm new to wargaming and I have a job interview tomorrow that has wargaming in the job description. What are three articles that I can read tonight so that I don't sound like an idiot? And, you know, we're really just looking to get more people interested in wargaming. And we've been really fortunate that the wargaming community has been so supportive of that, that Sebastian has been able to leverage his connection, both personal and professional, and that people have been really interested in what we're putting together. And, you know, for me on a personal level, it's super exciting to have folks reach out and say like, hey, you know, I never knew that that something like this existed. And I'm super excited to be able to talk to other people about, you know, my love for miniatures or my love for Hex and Counter games or the fact that I want to design the next Title 10 war game. And so I guess in summary, we're just looking to be like a cool place for anyone who's interested in wargaming with any level of experience to come and hang out and to learn something. And if there's anything that we don't currently provide, you know, we're always taking suggestions and asking folks like, hey, what do you want to see from us?
I got to ask, so because it's a college organization, presumably there's some sort of membership role somewhere. What's the headcount you guys have roughly?
So by my last count, we have 515 active members, and our
holy
metric,
crap.
Yeah, our metric for membership is just, have you signed up for membership on our listserv? And I actively track who's active because MailChimp gives you that function.
That,
so
yeah, that's not a club. That's a convention. I mean, that's a lot of folks. Wow.
Yeah, so like I said, it's been absolutely incredible. You know, we're up to almost 600 followers on Twitter. We've got like 400 something subscribers on YouTube, and everybody's super engaged and super nice to each other, which is awesome. You know, it's like being at a convention or being at Connections and just talking to other people about what you're excited about. So
let's back up. That's like being at Connections. I don't know that I'd characterize that as being at a convention. I've seen some very non-collegial discussions go on at some wargaming conventions over the years. So I would definitely say that sounds like Connections. I'm not sure that sounds like too many other conventions necessarily. So,
Fair enough.
Obviously, you guys have done some presentations on the games that came out of last semester's course. You guys did your presentation for Goose. Sawyer came and did a presentation on the Three Heroes or the Heroes Rising game. I always mangle the title on that one. I'm sorry, Sawyer, if you're listening, but she did that presentation for us when we did our virtual convention back at the end of July, and Sebastian came and talked about the class as well. I'm assuming at some point at some of these game nights, part of what you guys might want to do is getting some of the class projects on the table, or no? Are you focused on other less self-aggrandizing things?
So actually, Sebastian and I haven't talked about that yet, but that's a great idea. I mean, if we can find a way to let folks playtest or sort of see. But I'll let Sebastian talk more about that, because I'm sure he has more concrete plans since he's the one that's teaching.
Caitlin and Nikolai will remember is that I am famous to my first cohort of students that I always made them work even after they finished my class. So earlier this year, we originally in March were supposed to do this massive, sort of exhibition demo event with all the students' games, right? The program had funded a bunch of nice copies of their student design games, and they wanted to show them off. And we were going to have undergraduates and people outside the campus, and I invited professional wargamers to come, and then COVID struck. And then that event, along with a slew of other in-person events on campus, were canceled, unfortunately. But my hope is whenever we are back on campus is to do another event of that nature, where the students get to run their games and showcase their not only their research, but their skills as designers, but also a lot of them have grown very attached to their games. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if some of them end up on commercial shelves one day. But more than anything, it's great for the students to engage with people who don't know anything about their game, that is beyond the bubble of the class or even the program, and see their excitement. Caitlin and Nikolai can talk to you about their experience of running their games down at the Krulak Center, which was an event we did in January. And I'll hand it over to Nikolai first to talk about it.
We went down to the Krulak Center earlier this year. And I have to say that probably the most satisfying moment for me out of this class was already after the class was over and we had already gotten an A, when we were at the Krulak Center and we had a bunch of Marine Corps officers playing our game. And the Romans, with Belisarius in the lead, took Rome on pretty much the exact date that it historically happened. That's how you know that you have built your historical war game well enough. And, you know, they were just fantastic hosts to us. And, you know, it just really goes to show how much Sebastian is connected with the community. And I mean, really how Georgetown faculty in general know everybody in their fields. But I think that, you know, it's that sort of opportunity is not something that you get in other places. And I just think that by the time that we were all done with our games in class, Sebastian, you're completely right. We had, you know, essentially created something almost out of nothing. Caitlin and I didn't want to give up on it. That's why, you know, we're shopping the game around. That's why we've thought of 2-player and 3-player versions and expansions for the game and for the game system going forward. And I mean, and she can talk a little bit more about that if she likes, but I'll pass it over to her for what she liked at the Krulak Center and what she loved most about the class.
Real quick, before you dig too far into that, Nikolai, for the audience that may not have the full context to understand, what is the Krulak Center?
You know what? Maybe you should ask Sebastian that question.
So, Sebastian, I know, right? But you're not just talking to me. We're talking to the wider audience. What is the Krulak Center? Why does that matter?
So the full name is the Brooke Krulak Center for Innovation and Creativity, and it is a center within the larger Marine Corps University. And their job is to, just as their name suggests, is to foster critical thinking and innovation and creativity within the educational PME system to prepare the warfighters of tomorrow and the Marine Corps for the challenges of tomorrow. So in that regard, one of their roles within the Marine Corps University is to foster wargaming as an educational and as an experiential. So they have been great partners to us. The director over there, Colonel Valerie Jackson, and Major Ian Brown and Major Jared Cooper, they have been absolute amazing partners with us as we both for the class and the students to engage with them and the faculty and to see for me as an instructor, as a professor, to see my students engage active duty Marine Corps majors and lieutenant colonels and captains over a board game, talk about military history and strategy actively and enthusiastically is something special, right? And it's something especially special when when that game on the table that is binding them all together is something the students created out of their toil and work and blood and sweat and research. And that's a special moment. And the Krulak Center, I can't say enough good things about them.
Caitlin, any thoughts on your experience down there?
Yeah, I mean, I'll second what Nikolai said. They were amazing hosts. And I guess the best part about it for me, having some experience in the DoD wargaming space, is that, you know, we were bringing them student-created board games, essentially. And, you know, we weren't fancy contractors or war game designers or anything like that. And they were so engaged. They had excellent feedback for us. And Nikolai and I were actually able to make a few tweaks to our game based on the feedback that we got from the majors and lieutenant colonels who played our game. And, you know, there's something really cool about saying, hey, you know, 04s and 05s played our game on the Byzantine Empire and liked it, because that shows to me, at least, that there's, you know, educational value in gaming some of the more obscure historical topics, and that there's also, you know, an interest beyond just hobby gamers. You know, it was really cool to see that we had designed something that was engaging regardless of background and regardless of, you know, personal interest area. So I think that was my biggest takeaway, is that I had been nervous that, you know, we weren't designing anything that was super modern or you know, asymmetric warfare or anything like that, but they enjoyed it just as much as they enjoyed some of the more modern conflict focused games. So that was really cool to see.
Actually, I have to ask, two of the major projects from last semester were historical games. There was one in China and one in Rome. And has there been, I don't know if there's been any interest, have you shopped it around? Have you reached out to the actual history faculty at Georgetown and say, hey, we got these pretty cool games, y'all want to use them in your class teaching about the, you know, the history of China or anything? Has there been any interest just inside your own school for using these, you know, the games that were designed as teaching tools as teaching tools?
So one of the hard difficulties with that was there was some interest, but with the shift to the virtual environment and the fact that all the student games are non-digital and manual and in-person required, that has sort of put a pin in it. But there's definitely interest among the different faculty of how can we use wargaming, how can we create neural synergies? Because that was, like I said earlier in the podcast, is that that was one of the goals, is to sort of throw these games back into the system, right? Into a wider Georgetown University. So, I mean, one of my hopes in the future when we get back on campus and the students return to campus is that the notion that, you know what I mean, if there is a, you know what I mean, ancient world class on history, we can offer Nikolai and Caitlin's game on the Byzantine reconquest of Rome. Or if there's a China class, if a Heroes Rising game can be run as an event for Goose for that class or something else. Like, for example, I'm really excited for the hybrid warfare one and the China Vietnam War, because there are also sort of one is sort of a hot topic. The other one is sort of a historical byline, but it's also very interesting about how that region works and what are some of the consequences of that. So I'm very excited at the notion of it. We haven't done it quite yet, but that's one of the hopes. But one of the other hopes is that also to send these games beyond the university. And actually, we had more success on that front than within our own university, not because of lack of interest, but because some universities are more equipped. Last year or earlier this year, one of the games on the Peloponnesian War, which is designed by the same cohort as Caitlin and Nikolai, which was called Hellenic Struggle, which was, you know, borrowed from the mechanics of like Jason Matthews' great Twilight Struggle series, where influence is a big portion. It's not much of a like game about fighting in terms of like, you know, tactical or operational warfare. It's more about the high level strategic alliance building, alliance keeping. And one of the great things I like about their game is that they actually baked in sort of the notion of like the hegemonic maintenance costs of political theory. Like as you become the hegemon, you have to spend more money to maintain what you have, right? Things cost more, right? So that's something baked into their game rules, which is super interesting because like you can sort of run away with it after in the early bits. And then after you sort of hit this wall of being sort of like close to victory, it becomes really hard to finish that last mile in the game, allows your competitor to sort of sneak up on you, but they also have the same problem, right? So it's a very interesting dynamic in that game, and I really like it. And the Army War College actually asked us about it, and the designers released all their game materials and their rule books and all the instructions to how to assemble the game to the Army War College and Colonel Gilliam over there, who runs a fantastic shop over there. And they're going to build their copies and hopefully use it for their students over there.
We've only got a couple of minutes to wrap up, but I just did want to ask this question. So look, I've taught at the college level, but I've taught over in the communication and journalism world because that's my academic background. So one of the things that we've discussed in some of our classes was, let's try and get a definition of media together that we can all sort of kind of agree on. And folks, we spent an hour on this on the first night of the class, and folks would always get the center mass of the target is pretty easy to define, but the further you get from that center mass, the fuzzier the edges kind of get. We did another podcast long, long ago, like 5 years ago, on sort of what's the definition of a war game? And like that center mass is really easy to get, but kind of the further you get from Panzerblitz, right, the fuzzier it all starts to get. And is that something that you guys talk about in the class at all? And where did you start? Where did you end up? What kind of conceptual ground did you cover in, okay, so what is a war game?
So I'll take the first swag at it. So as an instructor, I don't spend too much time on sort of the definitional debate of what a war game is and is not. I sort of give them Peter Perla's definition as their definitive definition, which is really about core elements of human decision-making. It is an abstraction or a synthetic environment. It is about consequences of those decisions. And I think those are the key elements of what a war game really is. And you know, other people in the field debate about it, but for the purposes of my class, I'm like, hey, as we're creating educational board in the box games, this is how we're going to define war games, right? And again, that aperture widens as they go through their own research, but also through the readings over the weeks. And I will hand it over to Caitlin and Nikolai, who have their own experiences since my class, whether that definition still applies, if they have changed their opinion, because the whole point is that it's for that this class to be only a touchstone in the sense of their beginning state, not the destination of their knowledge. Caitlin first.
So I think that the definition that we were given in class of, you know, Peter Perla and sort of the Naval War College's definition of wargaming is what I tend to reference now moving forward. And it's an easy way to sort of say like, hey, you know, this is how professional wargamers think about wargaming. But what I will say is that, you know, separate from my interest in professional wargaming and my desire to pursue that as a career, personally, you know, what I've been able to build out from Sebastian's class is an understanding of the educational value of wargaming, and in particular, the fact that that education doesn't have to be in a classroom. It doesn't have to be, you know, a traditional DoD style war game. It can be playing a board game with your buddies over some beers on a Friday night. And if you have learned something about how to think about war or conflict or whatever the game topic is, then that has value. And in my mind, that can be considered a war game. Now, I wouldn't go using it to, you know, make a prediction about the future or say, you know, everything there is to know about history now. But I think that, you know, to Sebastian's credit, his class really provided a solid jumping off point for, you know, thinking about the field of wargaming as a whole from both the hobby and professional perspective, but also, you know, kind of framing how we want to move forward as Wargamers, because I think, you know, my impression has been that a lot of folks really look to Wargaming as a tool of analysis, and that is valid, and that is what is popular, and that is what pays the bills. But personally, I'm much more interested in the learning outcomes and, you know, what is the point of doing it? And the point of doing it to me is, you know, what do you learn? What kind of fun can you have? And what does that reinforce for you? So I'll leave it at that. And then Nikolai, if you have any thoughts to add, feel free.
I think you guys have raised excellent points. I think that the definition that we were given in class, at least in our syllabus, was a little bit narrower than I think what I have come to realize what a war game is. And I think that, you know, the essential components are all in that definition. You know, it's an abstraction of a conflict or a problem stated fairly oppositionally. And you have to go through a series of abstracted mechanics and decisions in order to reach an end state of some sort. But I think that the most important thing that we learned about good war games is that they are capable of not just abstracting the conflict and the context and everything like that, but they're really good at abstracting decision-making, and they're really good at abstracting realistic decisions, and especially oppositional decisions, in that your opponent has a vote on the outcome of the turn as well. And I think, you know, all kudos go to Sebastian for teaching us, you know, all of the fundamentals. And I think that what I found most interesting about our educational war games is the fact that we learned not just about the design decisions that go into making a war game, but also the decisions that you make within a war game and the things that you can draw from them. So I think that, as Caitlin said, analytical wargaming pays the bills, has incredible value. But I think to a much wider set of individuals, wargaming can teach people about how they make decisions, how they could make better decisions, of course, given the abstractions of their game, but also about the ways that other people make decisions with limited information, with more information, with less information. And it can really bring people together to realize that in a lot of cases, there isn't a stark right and wrong decision. There's a good decision and a worse decision. And I think the best war games are capable of abstracting that tension, and especially in conflict.
And I think that might be a good place to wrap all this up tonight. So thank you, all three of you, for taking time out this evening to come join us and preach the gospel of Goose and the wargaming program there. I know you guys exist in this weird space where we talk mostly hobby game stuff, but we do cover the professional wargaming stuff, and have had folks like Matt Caffrey and James Sterrett on the podcast before to cover that. And you guys kind of exist in the middle of that Venn diagram there. You're sort of bridging both worlds. And I think it's really neat. And Sebastian, especially the idea of let's start putting those ladders in place to get people into the professional wargaming world, I think is really cool. And you know, I think it's sort of doing the Lord's work there. It's great to see. And I'm stoked that such a thing exists, and kind of pissed that it didn't exist 25 years ago, sort of simultaneously. So from the home office here in Dragoon Land, Caitlin, thank you very much for joining us. Nikolai, thank you for being here. Sebastian, thank you for especially sort of steering a lot of this around, talking about the program and sort of pimping it out a little bit. Real quick, for anybody that's interested, obviously you got to be a Georgetown student to get there. Is it as simple as get into Georgetown and you can come start playing, once you're in Georgetown, there's still other hurdles you got to jump?
So in terms of the course, is that our program doesn't allow auditing. So you, to be in my class, you know, officially, you have to be a Georgetown student within the security studies program. To be part of Goose, you do not. So if you want to attend a Goose event, whether virtually or in person when we're back on campus, most of our events, like our webinar, are open to the public. For example, we have two virtual war games coming up this semester, one through the Army War College and one through the Naval War College and the Hoover Institute at Stanford. Both are open to the public, to anyone. So if you're in the Georgetown area and you want to come by for a Georgetown event that Goose is running, you're more than welcome. For my class, it seems like you will have to come and join our program, and we will be more than happy to have you. And our faculty is amazing, and I can recommend some other great courses at our program.
I know I've sat in on a whole bunch of the different presentations that you guys have done, you know, crashed the chat on a few of them, and I've watched a whole bunch of them after the fact as well. They're fantastic. Some fantastic talks that you guys have had over the last 6-8 months, whatever. And the lineup of speakers you've had has been pretty amazing. It's really been a who's who of who matters. And I was joking with somebody, I was like, they really need to slow down from the once a week, because this community isn't that big. Like, you're going to run out of people by next summer here, you know, at the rate you guys are going. But I'm always surprised that, you know, you pull somebody else out that, hey, we got another great topic here. Oh, that's kind of cool. It's just, you know, the small size of the community and the pace at which you guys are spitting out webinars, I'm sort of scratching my head going, they're going to run out of people sooner or later, aren't they? I mean, I hope not, but it just sort of scares me a little.
So one of the things that, so originally our webinar series was only supposed to be once a month, but then we amped them up as we started shifting more to the digital, and we had to cancel some of our in-person events. And as we go back to campus, we will probably slow them down. But while we're in this sort of pandemic mode of the new normal of being living on the virtual, is one of the ways we engage with our community and our members is through the webinars. And that's something we have been shockingly surprised, like yourself. We were like, we're gonna run out of the speakers. But one thing we've learned is that so many great people, especially since our aperture is quite large, in the sense that we include commercial designers like Maurice Suckling, who did Freeman's Farm, and Volko Ruhnke behind the GMT Coin Series. So we open our aperture just beyond just the DoD community, but even within the DoD community, we're finding people who are doing things that I didn't know about people who are doing interesting S&T gaming in the Air Force. So one of the new initiatives that we're doing with our webinar series is actually highlighting specific services and their wargaming efforts. So in October, we have a series of U.S. Air Force associated wargamers like Mitch Reed, who's from the Air Staff A5SW, who will be talking about the Title 10 games and how what the futures game that they run and what goes into that. And then we have like Lexi Bro, who's actually a student in our program starting the semester and is part of the Goose XCon, who works at AFWIC with Phil Boger, who will be talking about their adaptive gaming system that they're pioneering in their Air Force. So, and then in February, I was just earlier this evening was lining up speakers from the Navy. So we had Paul Weber, who will be talking about operational wargaming and wargame design for naval games. And then we have Pete Pellegrino from the Navy War College, who will be talking about the interwar period and the golden age of naval wargaming at the Naval War College. So, and then we hope to do similar series on the Army and the Marine Corps in the summer and the fall of the following year. But some of the things we want to do with our webinar series is to open the aperture for both professional gamers and commercial designers. And there's so many topics. And I joke with my students all the time is that all these great webinars will essentially make my class obsolete because they are hitting all the great topics. So like, for example, like Volko did a great topic on cards and in war game design. And he did so many great elements that I was like, I emailed my students. I was like, hey, go watch this webinar. It's really good. You'll get ideas for your own print and play games this semester as you talk about different ways to think about cards. And I think that's one of the great ways is that you're able to share that knowledge much more readily, and we should leverage that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Sounds great. Guys, I really appreciate you taking the time. Thank you very much. Audience, thank you very much for listening. We'll talk to you all again somewhere down the line.